residential technology, lighting specialist to arc residential tech.
Welcome to Residential Tech Talks. I'm Jeremy Glowacki, executive editor of Residential Tech Today. On this week's podcast, Tony Gramani joins us from The Road in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Tony was one of my favorite columnists during my days as editor at Residential Systems Magazine. He wrote broadly about the home theater category, which was apt given his career at Dolby, Lucasfilm THX, and as the owner of a theater design firm called PMI, as well as an acoustic materials brand called MSR Acoustics. As if those weren't enough irons in one fire, 6 years ago, he co-founded his own high-performance home theater loudspeaker brand, appropriately called Gramani Systems. I've been meaning to have Tony on the podcast for a while, but I always knew it was going to be one of those conversations that could go on for a while because there's just so much to cover. Tony, thanks for joining me today. Great to see you again.
Jeremy, great to see you. Like, I love calling you, hey, boss, how are you?
That's right.
I know we're going to have a good time, and I really appreciate the opportunity to get together and chat about this stuff.
Yeah, you kind of jumped on the comment that you're on the road. I didn't want anybody to think that you actually lived in Argentina. You're typically in Nevada, California, but you have a reason for being in Argentina. Is that the in-laws' place that you're going to? Is that what I read?
Right, right. I don't actually live here in Argentina. My wife is from Argentina. We met at the airport. I like to joke, and I'll explain that later. Fell madly in love, got married, have a kid, a little cute 3.5-year-old who will probably pop right in through that door, right in the middle of our conversation. He'll say, like, what are you doing in my room or something?
Right.
We're down here visiting the in-laws now that the pandemic, actually, we thought, had eased up. It's a little challenging down here too right now. But yeah, I'm on the road internationally a fair amount, and it's fun.
Well, that's exciting that we're able to talk from so far away. You said that was definitely not an easy trek to get there. It's a pretty long distance even from California there. I want to jump in though and kind of cover the early life of Tony Gramani. I have known you in the Cedia channel my whole time doing this. I knew about your background and some of the stops along the way, but we haven't really gotten into a lot of talk about it or details about it. But I don't really know anything about your upbringing and how you got into the audio. I definitely want to get to the THX story because I think everybody just wants to hear all about the ranch and all of that. But how did your life in home theater and audio kind of start as a young person? First of all, where did you grow up?
I'm glad we have a little time. And it's actually really cool to be able to just talk about that rather than tweeters, woofers, absorbers, diffusers, and integration. It always sounds weird when I actually say this, and what I'm about to say. One time, I got hauled off for secondary verification at an airport, coming back from Canada, because the person at customs was like, "No, that's not possible." So here's how it goes. I was actually born in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.
Okay.
From Australian parents. Immigrant, kind of first generation Australians. My dad was actually born in Greece originally. My mom was born in Germany. They met in Australia. And they met at the radio and TV station where my mom was a DJ and my dad was the chief engineer.
Okay.
My mom was a professional opera singer who had a radio show and then a TV show in radio and TV Australia on what's called ABC over there, which is the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. And my dad was one of the engineers there, and they met there, and both came from an international background and hung out at the international club and fell madly in love and got married. And then my dad took a job with UNESCO, with the United Nations Educational, Science, and Culture Organization. And in one of his sabbaticals, took a project in Kuala Lumpur to help build a technical university over there. And that happened to be where I was born while they were working on building this technical school. And so lived there for a little while, then moved to Australia for a really short time. And then my dad took another project with UNESCO, actually this time in Venezuela, not in Caracas, but in a little town called Barquisimeto, to do the same thing as he was doing in Malaysia, which is to put together a university. And his job was to organize the engineering labs, put together the curriculum, get the teachers, you know, just get the whole thing up and running. So a lot of people don't completely understand what UNESCO does, and I'm not sure that I understand all the things it does, but it's an international agency that governments mainly in developing countries can contract to do things, which is either to build a museum, build a university, fix up monuments like they did gloriously in Egypt about 40 years ago, et cetera. So after Venezuela, there was a few little stops along the way. After Venezuela, we lived in Miami for a little while, where my dad worked for an early biomedical company called Cordis. And he always regrets not staying there, because right after that, UNESCO asked if he wanted to join the mothership, the headquarters office, which was in Paris. And the story goes like this. My dad calls my mom and says, I just got offered a job in Paris. Do you want to go? Yes! My mom's dream always was to get back to Europe, opera singer, into music. And it's like, Paris, oh, let's go. So off we went to Paris. So I landed in Paris with my parents when I was 6 years old, and did all my primary school, you know, elementary school, junior high, high school, all the way through what's called there a baccalaureate, which is the diploma you get at the end of your high school process over there. And actually mainly in French schools, but in international sections of French schools, which is kind of interesting. So I kind of grew up around people from Lebanon and Japan and Korea and Argentina. Actually, I remember there was an Argentine woman in my class. And that was fun. It's fun. So,
so you're primarily speaking French during school then?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So my mother tongue, I guess, was English, because that's, you know, what was spoken part-time around the house, but really French was what I mainly grew up with, and still generally speak French. It's a little rusty. In France, I got really interested in electronics. So my dad's an electrical engineer, right? We're living in this tiny little apartment, which, by the way, by Parisian standards was huge. By U.S. standards, you know, it was under 1,000 square feet for, you know, full family with grandma. And my small bedroom, just about as big as this bedroom here in Argentina, was also my dad's laboratory. So he had a tech bench, all, you know, oscilloscope, generators, all this other stuff. And the dirty little secret is at night I would get up and like turn on all the gear and play with the oscilloscope. And, you know, goes like, I don't know what all this is, but it sure is fun. So I did that proverbial thing that you often hear is that at a young age, I'm dismantling things, looking at them like, what is all this? And, you know, putting it all back together sometimes. My dad would get totally crazy furious at me. It's like, no, you're not supposed to touch it. It's like, going, no. Still have all that gear, by the way. It's all in my warehouse, all his old scope and all of that stuff. And so I got interested in electronics. I joined a little electronics club. You know, they had one of those hobby electronics clubs, and also got into music. You know, my parents put me in music classes, and I studied at the conservatory in Paris. I studied mainly clarinet, which is a really difficult instrument for a kid to learn. You don't do much with a clarinet. You just, you know, play the concertos and things they give you, and not a very expressive instrument. So studied clarinet at the Paris Conservatoire de Paris. It's funny because I had my electronics and technical chops from my dad, you know, sort of infused there and sort of in the blood, and the music chops from my mom. You know, she was always practicing her vocal skills in the living room, you know, growing up, and we would go to concerts. She would perform in the beautiful old churches and cathedrals around Paris. That's a common place to go actually and perform when you're a musician. When there's not a pandemic, you know, every weekend you can look at the book of things going on and there's probably about 50 different or 60 different concerts you can go to at churches, and the acoustics are live and beautiful. Sure. And my mom would often be singing, and my dad would schlep along the tape recorder and record her singing, and we would go and cheer her on. So that's kind of the growing up years. And, you know, playing with audio with my dad, you know, so we built speakers. I had my own speaker in my bedroom. Then I started building some of my own stuff at about age 13 or 14. I built guitar amps for some friends that had a band in exchange for a motorcycle. So the trade was like, here's a guitar amp. I got a motorcycle. My dad hated that. He was like, no, motorcycles are dangerous. And motorcycles are dangerous, but, you know, knock
that's
on wood.
Cool.
I've survived that process. Still ride. And, you know, just always played with the stuff. And I always thought of it as a hobby. You know, we'd put a new car stereo in the car when we get a new car, and I'd enjoy it. Sometimes people ask me, like, when's the first time you really got the... And I don't know. I must have been 8 or 9, and I remember distinctly the Volvo my dad just got and, you know, ripped out the radio, and we put in a Blaupunkt radio, like the, you know, the best thing you could get at that time, and a pair of these little Blaupunkt ball speakers on the back deck and something in the door. And we flipped it all on. You know, I remember crawling around, running the wires and all that stuff, and we flipped it all on. And it's, you know, some of these things get ingrained in your brain, like these experiences. And I remember when we turned on the radio and he flipped it to stereo FM, because that was just when FM stereo was starting. Okay. Over there. And I remember hearing the sound going from, it's on in the car, to like that bloom of when you flip on stereo, and suddenly the air, you know, just like they say, like all the entire instrumentation went well like that. And I think that's when the vaccine hit, or the infection happened. It was like, wow.
Well, I have to say that this is more than I could have asked for a build up to where someone got interested in this field, because I had a note in my notes, my outline, interest in tech, music, science, ? And you kind of hit it all right there. Now, you eventually ended up in college at one of the California universities, correct? So how did you make the leap from Paris to California for college?
What's up with that? So so I did my schooling in the French system. It's a I think it's changed now, but at the time I went through there, it was a pretty archaic system. It was one of those very traditional, like the English and German and other school systems, where it's like, you are nothing, you are just a little nothing, sit down, listen. And, you know, start at 8 a.m, end at 5. So here's a 12-year-old or a 10-year-old that's asked to sit down and listen to these classes and write notes all that time. And it was tough. I was actually not a very good student. And I'll officially say, for those of you who know me that are watching this and know how much of a workaholic and a, you know, what, you know, people sometimes joke that I'm just too precision oriented. I'm like too, like, just like relax a little bit. It's like, well, you know, in school, I was not a very good student. I was like one of those guys, it's like, well, you know, I'm interested. And then I remember my report cards always going, he's really smart, but he could do so much better if he only paid attention. And it's like, I'm trying to pay attention as much as I can. It's like, and then I had the occasional good teachers. And I think it does come down for all of you guys who are teachers and who are good at it and who love doing it and who have a passion for it, you know, keep on doing it. You know, I know the pay's not great, but you can make such a difference to students. And I remember my physics teacher was one of those. My math teachers were not. They were like repeating their same notes of what they taught for 40 years. But I was fortunate to have a physics teacher that just loved the stuff and kind of got me caught me going with the elements of technology that relate to physics. So I finished my schooling there, passed my baccalaureate, and then I was like, well, so what am I going to do next? And a friend of my parents, who worked with them at UNESCO, suggested, you know, you should look at getting him into an American university with a degree from a U.S. university. You can usually go to most parts of the world You know, be it Australia, if they wanted to go back there, go to Malaysia, go to wherever. And, you know, if you come from a well-known U.S. university, it opens doors. People will go, yeah, okay, I've heard of University of California. It's cool. So originally it was decided I was going to study medicine. So I applied to a bunch of colleges. Ultimately, I chose to go to UC Davis on a pre-med program. Mm-hmm. And, you know, still loved engineering, but I always thought of audio engineering and stuff like that as a hobby. It's like, you know, it's a thing you play with. I don't know why. It wasn't in my mind that I would ever work in this career. So off I went and started pre-med. And I didn't do so well in the biological sciences part of it. When I hit what I called biochemistry. It got really hard. And a lot of it is about remembering a lot of facts and a lot of equations, a lot of formulas. And it wasn't quite for me. But at the same time, I was taking engineering courses because somewhere in the back of my mind, I was thinking of doing biomedical engineering. My dad had done some of that. He loved it. And I was like, yeah, that sounds really interesting to get into the field of designing machinery and technology for medical applications. So I'm taking medical or pre-med classes that I'm not doing so well in. And then I'm taking electrical engineering classes that I'm doing great in. I'm absolutely loving it. And so somewhere along the way, I just changed my major from pre-med to electrical engineering because that was easier for me. And I know electrical engineering is easy, whatever. So I ended up specializing in electrical engineering, specializing in analog circuit design and broadcast and things that gradually all went to what audio and video equipment is for broadcast and design of amplifiers, design of things that relate to audio. And so did that. Big shout out along the way. There was a college station at UC Davis called KDVS. It was, as college stations go, it was well-funded. It had a 5,000-watt transmitter that carried most of the Sacramento Valley. You know, usually college stations have really small transmitters. They can barely hit the edge of the town. This thing carried all the way as far as, you know, big flat valley, big antenna on the top of a tall building, carried really far. And I joined the radio station originally as a DJ. And on my first night, the main monitor pot, the actual level control for the monitors in the room fell out of the board. And so I'm like fixing it to make the evening show work. And I eventually volunteered to be an assistant engineer and eventually became the chief engineer of this radio station, got my FCC license to do that.
And that was as a student?
Okay. And big shout out to that station because the regents of the University of California never really wanted to support it. It sort of seemed like, why are we paying for this? And it's like, well, because a lot of actually, as it turns out, a lot of very famous entertainers, reporters, politicians all went through that station. And, you know, it was a breeding ground for a lot of useful training. And that I got my first sort of professional audio engineering job at that radio station. Towards the end of my college career, it was badly in need of a rebuild. The studios were old and falling apart. The wiring was just not right. And I put in a bid to the regents to actually rebuild all the studios and did that. So tore the whole thing down, rebuilt the two main control rooms, put all new equipment, new board, new turntables, new everything. It was turntables at the time. You know?
Yeah.
new tape decks. Actually got a really nice Studer machine that probably runs perfectly all these years later. And you know, that was sort of my, I forgot to mention another thing I did in college, but that was like a really important element that I would encourage anybody who is studying engineering or whatever. You know, there are resources around you that can get you started so that you have something on your resume. And when I went to apply for a job at Dolby right out of college, you know, that was one of the things on there. It's like chief engineer at the station. I showed some pictures of the projects and stuff. It's like, wow, you've done that? It's like, yeah.
And yeah, that's a pretty big college job right there. Yeah. That's not an internship. That's like a full on, first job. Yeah. And you're still a student. So, what was the other thing that you said in college kind of was a milestone or a big point for you?
In college, of course, I did school, but I also did music. So I got to UC Davis, and the guy on in the dorm, the guy on one side of me played electric guitar. And I remember it's like I'm a freshman and, you know, I learned a little bit of classical guitar when I was also at the conservatory. And this kid next door at age, you know, 17, 18, played rock guitar like a god. He, like, he did leads and all this shit. I was like, oh, my God, I got to learn how to do that. So I went and took the, you know, learn how to play rock guitar course taught at the university. And, you know, within a few weeks, I was playing some chords and then started to practice and practice and practice. And I would practice quite a bit. Got pretty good at electric guitar and then joined a band. And then I started to join other bands and started to play and played a lot of music, as much as there is time when you're in college because you still have to study.
Yeah.
And then the guy on the other side had a saxophone that was his father's originally that you know, he would play once in a while. I was like, well, that's kind of like playing the clarinet, but it sounds a lot better. So he loaned me his saxophone, which I eventually bought and I still own. And so I started to pick up the guitar from one kid in the dorm and saxophone from the other one. So I ended up playing both instruments through college and ended up playing a lot. And somewhere along the way, I picked up a gig playing with this band called the Violent Femmes, which...
No way.
Yes way. So they came to town. They were booked in a little nightclub locally, which actually ended up shutting down just a few weeks before their gig. And I lived at that point, I lived off campus in a house shared with a bunch of people. We had this huge living room, like the owner of this house had expanded into this club sized living room. And we got called by the guy who was running the promotion of their concert, said, I know you have parties in your house once in a while. The Violent Femmes are coming into town. Would you mind if, you know, the venue is closed. Do you mind if we have them play in your living room? It's like, Violent Femmes playing in my living room. Yeah, sure. So they come and play in the living room. And along the way, they go, hey, do you know anybody who plays, you know, horns? They like to pick up horn players on their gigs and just play a few songs, just, you know, loosey-goosey. It's like, well, I'll play the saxophone. Great, you're hired. So in my living room in front of, you know, the people at UC Davis that liked alternative music, I played a few songs just kind of really quickly. They told me what key it was in. They said, they asked me, so you play okay? Yeah. Do you know how to play Primal? Okay, Primal. I think I know what you mean. You know, that was it. That was like the instruction. Play Primal. Okay, key of G, go. And so I just played along on this song called Black Girls. And then when it was time, they pointed at me. I did one of these solos that was very avant-garde, sounded like a screaming electric guitar lead with all kinds of and like screaming into the reed and everything. And like,
okay,
would you like to go on tour with us?
Wow.
So the thinking process was about a quarter second. It was like, yeah. So I went and toured with them for a little while. You know, it was getting close to finals week. And I said, whatever, man. So I ran around with them for a while. And what was fun is I ran around with them for a while long enough to go, you know, I don't really want to do this when I'm 40.
Okay. Yeah.
This is a lot of fun, but I can tell that this could get old.
Yeah. So wait, now, was this toward finals of your, like, the middle of college or late?
Senior year.
Oh my gosh. So you were trying to wrap up, but you're just like, that can wait. I can come back.
That can wait. Yeah. You know, and it's funny because I think a lot of the work I've done has been a little bit like that, where like an opportunity shows up where you go, I can't pass this up. This is amazing. I got to do this. So,
so did you just, were you US tour, kind of gigs or what was it?
It was only West Coast at the time.
Okay.
You know, all crammed into the van and drove up and down. And you
know, yeah, I don't really know their history so much, but I did see them later on. I was kind of checking. I had to look at your graduation date, which is 84, correct?
Yeah. It was supposed to be 84. I ended up graduating in it. You know, it took 85 because I went to my professor and was like, I'm not going to be able to do finals. What can we do? And most of them were very gracious about it. It's like, okay, we'll hold off on this. Some of them said, like, you're going to have to take the class again. But other ones were like, you know, we'll put it on hold. You can do a catch up final later. We'll do orals, you know, whatever. So
yeah. Well, I saw that band in at the 40 Watt Club in Athens, Georgia, where I went to school in 92. So it was a bit later on, but yeah. Still great. I love that. That was one of the
great band. They still perform. I played with them last year at a club in Berkeley, California. They're still great. It's amazing, actually. So, you know, I was like, you know, this is going to be ugly when we're 40. Well, those guys are now probably 50 or late 50s.
Yeah, for sure.
And are still putting on an amazing show. So testament to like how good you can actually sustain the thing. The energy's still there. They haven't gotten like, so anyway. It was a lot of fun, I got to say.
So you get a little bit delayed in your graduation, but was your first job out of college Dolby then?
Yeah.
So what did you do at Dolby?
So I joined, actually the story of how I could go on forever with this, but I'll just mention this really, really. So I'm back in college. I finally graduate. I finished the radio station. I'm like, okay. And, you know, the band's trying to figure out. At that point, this band I played in called Vox Humana, we're on our second album. We're getting some pretty good gigs. And we're like, you know, what do we keep doing this? And I'm looking for jobs. And all that I'm seeing out there is jobs for military contractor. I applied for a job at Johnson & Johnson on a line that would make feminine hygiene products. And I was like, oh, whatever. You know, it's an engineering job. We'll be fine.
Yeah.
And then I'm actually looking through the newspaper because the van we used for the band transport blew up, like, and I was tired of fixing that engine. I still work on my old, I have an old 1937 car. I have some old machines.
Oh, I saw
used to do a lot
of
mechanic stuff. My hands were always dirty, just fixing cars, motorcycles and bicycles. And so I was the guy who was fixing the van. It finally blew up. I'm like, we're going to buy something a little newer. I'm flipping through the newspaper looking for, you know, something, a Ford van, Dodge van, something. And like, I flipped through the paper and like, there's an ad for Dolby. I was like, whoa, Dolby's hiring. It's like, I never thought that I could get a job in the audio business. Hadn't even crossed my mind. I always thought I'd just be working for an ordinary corporation. So I applied for the job, got asked to an interview. The interview was the day after our most important gig. We got a gig at a club in San Francisco. It was called the Keystone. And the band was like, you are doing this gig. I don't care that you have an interview the next day. You're doing this gig. Okay. So played at the Keystone. It turns out Dolby was two blocks away or a block and a half away from the Keystone. It was on Broadway. So stayed up late enough to finish the gig and be, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed at the interview the next day. And, you know, aced the interview, all the technical questions they asked me, you know, I could answer. It all made sense. Like, well, yeah, this is what I do for a hobby and have studied electrical engineering and all the stuff. And then the guy who's interviewing me goes, well, so do you, do you play any music? It's like, well, I play some guitar and some saxophone. It's like, oh, cool. Do you play in a band? And it's like, I play in a band. Well, what's the name of the band? Oh, it's Vox Humana. He looks at me. It's like, you were playing on Broadway yesterday, last night, nice, at the Keystone. I saw it on the marquee. And I'm like, oh, I'm so busted. I'm like, they're not going to give me this job. They don't want to, you know, rock and roll or, you know, hanging out. And I was wrong. They were like, that was it. I found out later that was really important to them, that I was active in music and that I could stay up late enough to finish a gig and the next morning be semi-coherent. And that was,
well, Tony, so just for a quick interlude here, what was the what was Dolby in your mind when you saw that ad? What were you thinking Dolby was associated with? Was it something you saw in movie credits or was it some kind of a button on a car stereo? What was Dolby at that time?
So Dolby at that time was already very firmly implanted in movie theaters, right? So the obvious big hit with Star Wars, but you know, everything you saw that was big in the theaters was Dolby Stereo, which didn't mean two channel. It meant surround sound. That's the term in movie sound, of stereophonic sound is actually immersive surround sound. And I was also familiar with the noise reduction technology used on both professional and consumer technology. And the job was actually in the licensing department, which was working on engineering of licensable technologies. I didn't know much more than that because the ad wasn't clear. Mm. But what they were looking for and they hired me for was somebody who would take care of the microchip development. So microchips for mainly Dolby B and C type noise reduction. There's this technology called HX Pro, and that was about it. There was other little side technologies, but that was the main thing. So they hired me as a chip designer to work with the manufacturers that made microchips under license to be put into cassette decks largely.
Mm. Okay. And was that something with your college degree with engineering that you're doing chip design stuff already?
Yeah. That was, when I chose to specialize in analog circuit design, I mean, I also did digital stuff, but you know, the analog stuff is really what was my passion, is like knowing how to design audio stages and analog circuitry. That's what I was like, you know how to do that? And they gave me some circuit diagrams and said, well, can you analyze this? Like, well, yeah, this does this and that and this and that. And then they were like, what's wrong with this string? It's like, well, that's not going to work. The gain structure of that's going to over. And it was like, okay, so you know this and that. That's what I did. It was actually helped design microchips for analog chips. Don't ask me to do that anymore. I don't remember it. It was years ago.
Okay.
So what was interesting, maybe you're going there, I don't know, is I, in addition to all these passions I had or that I mentioned, is I was also really interested in, at the time, what I would call quadraphonic sound or surround sound. From hearing that at a friend's house, one of my friend's dads brought back a receiver. I think it was probably a Sansui with quadraphonic sound in it, and put up some extra speakers. And man, we would just play with that stuff and listen to all the QS and SQ recordings he would have. And it was like, wow, that's really cool. So I had, an interest in that. And I'm just joined Dolby. I'm there to design B-type and C-type noise reduction chips primarily, but there's some noise going on in the background about bringing surround the Dolby stereo experience into the home. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of poo-poo. So there's a contingent of, really, there's actually my predecessor, Steve Solari, remember him, if you're still listening, hello, was also interested in that. And I was like, I'm kind of hearing this, and it's like, what's this about the surround program? It's like, that'll never work. People don't want more speakers at home. The quadraphonic era came and went. Forget about it, young man. Go back and design, noise reduction chips. It's like, I don't know. It seems kind of fun. Home videos around. It seems kind of like cool. And I got more and more interested in it, and kind of formed this little Skunkworks coalition of a few people that, despite the fact that the top brass was saying there's no future in promoting surround sound for home applications, we're like, no, we think there's something. And Roger Dressler was one guy you once in a while you hear of. Dennis Statz, who's doing something different now in the industry. Steve Solari and I were like, we think we should do this. And so we pushed and pushed and pushed, and actually eventually convinced management, Ray Dolby, president of the company also, and the top brass, it's like, we should push this program. And the rest is history. It's everywhere now.
And how involved were you with that after it was finally accepted as a plan?
Very. So we had to develop circuitry that was applicable for home applications, and then develop communication programs for the licensing to go show it to all of the manufacturers under license, get it accepted, build it, and then promote it out into the market. And it was very, very involved in that. It was my involvement in that kind of caught the attention of Tom Holman and other people at Lucasfilm.
Yeah.
Who about 5 years later decided they were going to start to take what had been built at Dolby in the nascent home theater program and put the layer of THX technologies on top of that. And they were looking for somebody and asked me if I wanted to join there.
Yeah. So what was their secret sauce? I know THX in the theater realm as well, the commercial theater realm. So what were they looking to do to enhance what Dolby was working on, what right. you would come up with at Dolby then, and when you joined them, what was that plan like?
Right. A good plan. Otherwise, I wouldn't have joined. So yeah. the way I like to describe it is Dolby has always been an expert at super efficient packaging of audio or video. Actually, Ray Dolby started as an engineer at Ampex working on video machines, figuring out how to do noise reduction so that the dynamic range of the video could be better, and kind of took some of that learning into forming the Dolby Corporation. So they always found a way to take music with a dynamic range this big, squeeze it down into a medium that's only this big, and then expand it back out. So that it's restituted as it originally was. And that was the concept of the noise reduction, is to essentially, quote unquote, compress the dynamic range onto the tape and then expand it back out. And by the expansion, you push the noise down. Hmm. And in Dolby Stereo, Dolby Surround, they found a way to take four channels of sound and squeeze them down into the two available channels. And then upon playback, expand them back out into four.
Okay.
These days, they're in the business of taking 32 channels of sound, squeezing it down into a track that can only take six channels of sound, and then open it back up into something that's 32 channels. So it's sort of their core expertise, and they're amazing at that. The amount of brain power that's there is ludicrous about what they know in terms of how to do that. And it's as intense, essentially, as the teleporting process in Star Trek, where you take the person and then you vaporize them and then you expand them back out into a person. It's almost that great in terms of audio video. Okay. Past that, it's like, well, here's our 32 channels of sound, and now what do you do with that? And yeah. that's where THX takes over. THX says, okay, well, this is the way it was heard in the production studio, in the actual film studio environment. Here's the standards for how the speakers are decided and set up and tuned and put in place, how the acoustics are built. And we're going to transport that knowledge into the movie theater originally. So we're going to build movie theaters or help build movie theaters that sound and look just like the studio environment. And then later home theaters that have the same audio and video quality as what you would see in a studio. Mm-hmm. So that's really the shtick at THX is, you know, how to, once the channels have been found back, you know, how do we present this so that the oral experience and visual experience is exactly as the director intended? That's the propaganda. It's a good propaganda. It's really what they do.
Right, right. So that's kind of the certification of a theater and all of that, that standard that you create and right. all the elements and technology.
So the certification.
That needs to support it.
So sometimes people say, well, the way you get a certification is you pay money. It's like payola. That's a complete lie. That's a poo-poo conservative reactionary approach at it. No. Before a theater can be certified, the certification just says that the theater has designed the room correctly, has built mm-hmm. it correctly, has installed all the gear correctly, and has calibrated it correctly. They've done all of their work, just like getting a diploma. You've gone through all of your courses. And you get your diploma. It means you meet the standards. And every year it gets retested and readjusted and recertified. And same thing with home THX equipment. The product mm-hmm. has been designed and built per the standards. In the case of home THX, there's also some patented technologies that go in it to make the sound of a small room, you know, a room that may be 22 feet long, appear like it's the same sound as a room that may be 150 feet, like a movie theater. The home THX gear has a combination of design and quality standards together with patented technologies that get put in there to make that simulation work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, well, I do want to continue. I want to get a little bit more into detail about your time at THX, and then how you transition into your current career. But first, we're going to just take a short break.
Did you know that 34% of broadband households are concerned about the air quality inside of their homes? Parks Associates' new quantified consumer study, Fresh Air, Air Quality and Comfort in the Smart Home, addresses consumer concern regarding indoor air quality as well as interest in air quality products and services. Our research of 10,000 broadband households finds that about 20% of broadband households are likely to purchase a smart climate or indoor air quality device in the next 6 months. This new consumer analysis quantifies concerns, perception of product value, and purchase intentions. For more information on fresh air quality, and comfort in the smart home, contact sales at parksassociates.com.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Tony Grimani. Tony, as you kind of went along in your career at THX, I know that you said you worked with Tom Holman, who is a legend in surround sound. Were you also crossing paths with George Lucas while you were there?
Yeah, I was. Let's pause real quick. Jeremy, your camera looks like it's a little out of focus. It was beautiful for a long time, and suddenly it looks like it may be trying to focus on something different.
Yeah, I think we're okay on the stream. Alan, I think can confirm
on
that.
How does it look to you, Alan? Okay.
Yeah, right. so we can
Sorry.
Clean that up. No problem.
Now back to our program.
Yeah.
Why don't you ask that again?
Yeah. So when you were at THX, you mentioned working with Tom Holman, who's a legend in surround sound and one of the pioneers there at THX. And were you also crossing paths with George Lucas at the time?
Yeah. So there were occasional meetings and discussions with George, as we called him. George is a storyteller. He's an artist and didn't want to get too involved in the issues of cameras, microphones, loudspeakers. So it was like, yep, you know, just make sure it sounds good. Yep. It's all great. Do your thing. Really appreciated the work THX did to ensure that the art, you know, the extensive amount of picture production and sound production that Lucasfilm always did, now a lot of other people do that too, could be conveyed. Because there's no point in putting a lot of effort into really good cinematography, really good visual effects, really good audio recording and audio post-production if the playback environment is poor. You know, you're just basically wasting your time. So he appreciated that we were there essentially to act as curators for the art form.
Okay. Well, we could probably talk THX forever, but I really want to kind of go into what you do today and what you've been doing for a while. What was the decision to go out on your own and I guess become a theater designer, a home theater designer? Would that be is that how you would kind of explain what you did there in that career move?
I would. I'm often referred to when I'm working with architects and builders as the home theater consultant or the designer. Is an interesting decision. So I was at THX for almost 10 years and I was happy. It's all good. There was no problems. But I kept noticing that expensive home cinemas, private screening rooms, whatever you want to call them, home theaters, I call them home cinemas, were often designed without... Even though we did our training, I was always like, man, I wish there was somebody out there as a consultant that could help these guys do a better job. And I would steer, I would be in touch with dealers and I would steer them to this acoustical company or that acoustical company. But I noticed that a lot of projects got done with good equipment, but not very good acoustical or optical design for the rooms. Why? Because it's complicated. Why? Because the architect didn't want to, because the interior designer had, a say in it. And I was like, wow, somebody should start a company that really specializes in doing this. And, a little shout out to my buddy, Russ Herschelman on this, because I think he's the one that kind of pushed me over the edge. It's like, well, you should do that. Like, no, I work here. Well, it's like, you should just start a company that helps design home theaters.
Now what was Russ was a dealer, right? Early Cedia integrator. How did he know you? How are you guys crossing paths?
Russ was in our area. He's sort of a friend of THX. I met him very, very early on, like a lot of dealers, just that came to the ranch for the training and we stayed good buddies from that. But his office was just essentially right down the road from Skywalker Ranch where I worked. And we got together regularly to just chat about the industry. We enjoyed each other's company. And he is the one who who caused this. It's his fault. And who's like, yeah, you know, you should start a company. So it took me about a year for this to cogitate and just get into it. And it's like, okay, you know what? What the hell? Just kind of like jumping in the van and going touring with the Violin Femmes. It was like, you know what? Sure. I'm going to start that. So it actually took me another year to leave THX because, you know, it was a lot of work to do. I loved my boss, Monica Dashwood. We got along really well, did great work. So it kind of wound down for a year and then started a company that specializes in designing home cinemas and now recording studios and a bunch of other things related to the engineering of acoustics and optics in media spaces. So I decided not to call it home theater design specialists or something like that. It's called Performance Media Industries, PMI, because it's all about offering a system or offering a service to design media environments for high performance use.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
So I started that in 99. Mm-hmm. So we're now into 22 years. We've done 1,000 projects. I can't believe it's been that many.
Wow.
All over the world. We've designed a complete film post-production facility in Mongolia, in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. I've been there. Worked on projects in Israel, in Russia, in France, in England, and, you know, and a few in the USA too.
Yeah, quite a few. Well, you and I talked a little bit before the recording that the international experience and the folks that you work with, the integrators in different countries, continue to impress you. What do you think? I think a lot of people in the US maybe not quite as aware of that international extension of that CEDIA type integrator and how great the quality of the work is, just from Americans going abroad, but international folks who are learning to do this stuff really well. So what have you seen out there?
Yeah. So working on projects in Mexico and projects in England, projects in Australia, I've been blown away, actually, not just impressed, but blown away with the caliber of the designers and integrators in those countries. There's sort of an assumption that, you know, in the US is where the sophisticated stuff happens and everywhere else it's sort of poo-poo, you know, whatever, low end, and it's not so. People in those foreign countries that I'm working with are often electrical and mechanical engineers that work for integration firms and are often extremely creative and meticulous about what they do. And it is very gratifying to see CEDIA expanding as an international operation and having people from foreign countries on the board in top committees. Like right now, I'm working on two very important committees that are doing important engineering work and standards work. And one of them is run by an Englishman who spent a lot of time doing work in the Middle East, now works for an Italian company. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just great to have that international input. And there's what's really cool about it is not just to notice that, yeah, people in Australia know how to design a really good theater and build a really good theater. And that's cool. But when you go to other places, you see different ways to go about solutions. And there's a great learning from looking at how they build stuff in other countries. And, you know, I do encourage people in the U.S. to, you know, keep your minds open to what people are doing in other countries. Look at what the integrators are doing. I love it when the winner of a award for, mm-hmm. you know, every year CEDIA has the awards for best this and best that. And often the winner is somebody from a different country these days. And, right. you know, look at those projects. Look at how people in Mexico go about building a theater, given what they have to do in their construction standards. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I've even experienced that. I get the honor of being a Lutron Excellence Judge every year, and it's a lot of international projects that are just amazing, huge homes and really beautiful work. You know, of course, that's just one element of an integrated home, but it's a really great one to show your artistry. Mm-hmm. What about when you're doing a project? How much of the, let's say it is a dedicated home theater, how much of that project are you influencing? Where does your role kind of stop and the integrator, the like a room interior designer type person take over?
Yeah. So every project's a little different depending on the culture of the project, but the typical project we're brought in by the integrator as a resource to help engineer the room and produce a set of plans. So our role is usually very early on in the design of a residence or a commercial space when things are just still at basic architectural plan. And there's an area that said, well, this is where the home cinema, the theater is going to be. And we look at that and we talk with all the stakeholders, you know, how many seats do you want? How loud do you want it? How big of a screen are you looking at? And then we engineer the room to figure out what kind of speakers they need, where the seats got to be, what the riser heights need to be. How do you design the ventilation system, the electrical system? How do you design the wall structures so that there's proper sound isolation from rooms above or rooms below, rooms laterally? And then we design the internal acoustics so that the sound that's leaving the speakers is properly supported by the room and not echoed in an uncontrolled way in the room. And so we'll engineer all that. We've got this 45-page spreadsheet we use to like figure out all the numbers. And we put that on a plan set. And usually our plan set's 40 or 50 pages of every detail. So this wall has to be built this way. And every wall structure has maybe two or three pages showing all the different views of how you build it. Where do the screws go? Where do the isolators go? How do you put the sealant caulk here and there and all of these different things. And then we work with a construction team to make sure it gets built correctly. So we go on site and verify that they're following the plans correctly, modify the plans if there's any unforeseen changes, and then work with the integrator to put the systems in and then tune them. So very often the projects are between 100 and 200 hours of work, so fair amount of work. And we're very involved essentially as an engineer resource to make sure the room comes out well. Mm-hmm. And so to be fair, you could, without hiring us, if you're lucky, you could put all the stuff in the right places. And if everything falls into place, you could actually win the lottery. And there's a one chance in a million that you'll win the lottery or less. or you hire somebody like us or some of our colleagues. We're not the only firm that does this now. There's about four or five good companies. And a homeowner, a builder, and certainly an integrator should look at hiring us because there's a meticulousness about the engineering that's hard to get until you do it enough. And ultimately the idea is, look, we kind of want to make sure that you build this only once. You know, don't build it. Oh, that didn't work. Tear it down. Rebuild it. Oh, that didn't quite work either. Tear it down. We just want to make sure it's properly thought through, built, and then it works right. So, did that answer your question?
Yeah. So how much of the finish work are you influencing? Because that's part of the acoustics. It's not necessarily the base, you know, the foundational acoustics, but you're not a interior designer, so there's someone else that's kind of doing those pieces, like the walls and the seats and all that.
So I'd say about 20% of our projects, we do the interior design. So we're hired to take it all the way to the end, including, you know, what does the interior look like? What's the fabric? What's the colors? 80% of the time, the project has an interior designer already assigned. The architecture firm may have an interior design division, or in most cases, there's an interior designer hired by the homeowner to basically tie the whole house together so that the design follows through. It's all beautiful. And so 80% of the time we're working as a resource, as an advisory resource to the interior designer to make sure that what they're putting in place will allow good picture and sound. And so at that point we're influencing, right? And we're not the designers, but we're influencing the designer to make sure they understand why we need fabric here and where do you put wood? Where do you put metal? Where do you put lights? Where do you put different colors in the room so that everything ends up coming right optically and visually. And that's fun. So for the record, I actually love working with interior designers. I am actually absolutely blown away that a person could just be thinking of something, just draw it up on a little sketch and then, you know, do a construction development of it, get these little samples of fabric and paint, and in their mind's eye kind of go, I think it's going to work out. And you build it all and you go, wow, it's amazing. And you could figure all this out from these like little pieces of paint color. It's a skill. So big hats off. Any interior designers or architects listening, you know, hats off, because that's a very special skill.
Where was the decision to start manufacturing acoustics or Is that what that is? MSR is an actual brand of product, correct?
Right. So a number of years into PMI engineering, we got frequent requests from builders that you know, would look at our plans and go, you know, so I see all the stuff. I don't know where to get all these absorber diffusers, base absorbers, all the stuff, all these isolators. Can you just, you know, put together a complete bill of goods and a proposal for supplying that? And we're like, well, that's not what we do. And we got enough questions. It's like, well, maybe we'll start doing that. And so we started vending the materials to people to see how well that worked. And it aided the process because the what ended up showing up on site is actually what's in the plan. Mm-hmm. And then one thing led to another. We actually started to design our own line of absorbers and diffusers to fulfill a need we saw in doing things that other manufacturers didn't do. And then another thing led to another, and I had a long dinner with a guy called Keith Olson, 6-time Grammy Award winning producer and engineer who's got great album credits to his name. He did a lot of Fleetwood Mac, Pat Benatar, Santana, Grateful Dead, Whitesnake. He got really well known for the LA big hair metal clean sound. And he left the recording business to go work for Mackie making recording equipment, speakers and recording equipment. And he kept noticing that a lot of the people they sold stuff to didn't know where to get acoustics. And he was like, you know, I love what you're doing with this, you know, these things. We should start a company and like, you know, make these products as packages. And he convinced me to start a new company, MSR Acoustics, where we are our main, I guess our main business model is not only do we sell absorbers and diffusers, but we give a recipe, kind of like those people now where you can, there's a bunch of different companies, I won't name them, but you can sign on to them and they will deliver you all of the ingredients for your dinner tonight. So I
put your front door
in a little fridge is all the things you need and a recipe to like cook it all up. And that was sort of the concept is we're going to figure out from your room sizes that you need this package. Here's the price, order it, decide whether you want it in red, blue, or green or whatever, and it will show up and install it. And that's the main kind of the business approach of MSR Acoustics across the years is let's just make this easy for you and package it.
And then that brings us up to Grimani Systems, which I sat through your initial presentation at CEDIA where you talked about finding a client who was really willing to help you get this thing off the ground. And there's so many speaker brands. What was it that you felt like was special that you needed to do differently with your speakers?
Yeah. So that story has a why to it. Why we even got into that. I was really pining for speakers made in a certain way for the integration business. A lot of speaker companies would just take their regular product and go, here, integrate this. And, you know, integrators made it work. They would take speakers that were meant to be in the room and, you know, hide them in this wall and that thing and that thing. And companies like Triad and other ones, you know, started going from being kind of hi-fi companies to integration companies. But I felt like there was a bunch of things that could still be done to make it easier to integrate. And I kept asking for this and asking for that from different speaker companies. It's like, you know, will you make a speaker that does this? And will you make a speaker that does that? And it was like, yeah, that's just not really what we do. And I was like, okay, whatever. I wish you did, because then I would just spec that in. And then I know it would work. It would be easier to install. So that was one impetus that, you know, there was, I had a dream that speakers would be made this way. One, two, I hired as a chief engineer, a guy I'd met many years before by the name of Manny Lacaruba, who was the chief engineer of the Plant Recording Studios in the Bay Area in Sausalito, very famous recording studio. Whoops, just dropped, speaking of recording studios, just dropped my microphone. I'm back. And great album credits for very, very famous bands. Like, you know, just look it up, The Plant. It's amazing how many really, really famous albums got recorded there. And he retired from that. And he invented this new waveguide technology, which his purpose was to actually have, interestingly, a lot of what THX always claimed you should do in designing a speaker, which is a really even horizontal dispersion, some amount of focus vertically, but a very constant directivity. Constant directivity, meaning that the sound on axis has the same character as the sound off axis. Maybe it's lower in level off axis, but it's the same frequency response. And he obsessed over that, actually, all the way from his college years. He studied music and music technology in at what's called SUNY Fredonia in New York. And with Dave Moulton, started to invent these ways to design mid and high frequency drivers that had really even dispersion and even sound power or constant directivity. Those are all different words to describe the same thing. So he had developed this new waveguide that he ended up licensing to Bang & Olufsen. And was sort of in semi-retirement. It's like, hey, you know, Manny, I need a chief engineer to help us do designs. Will you join what we do? So he became our chief engineer for PMI engineering. Okay. But he kept noodling with these waveguides, and he came up with this new version of this really nice waveguide. He was like, wow, it'd be really nice to put this in a home theater. And we built some prototypes and built our own little prototype theater. It's like, wow, that sounds really good. And so then I tried to help Manny license that new waveguide to different manufacturers, and people looked at it like, I don't know what to do with that. And I've got two dreams. One is that someday people will use this waveguide to make really good speakers for home theater, one. And two, someday people will make active speakers that have this kind of character and this kind of performance and these shapes and this dynamic character. And it just sat there going like, yeah, whatever, maybe someday somebody will do this. And the turning point was a client of ours liked so much what we did for his listening room that said, hey, you know, I love what you guys are doing. You know, I'd love to do work with you guys. I'd love to invest in what you're doing. And we're like, well, we have this prototype speaker concept over here. Do you want to hear it? And we actually cobbled it back together. He put a little funding money together to build actually a system. And we gave him a demo. He was like, oh my God, that sounds so much better than what I've got in my high-end room now. And I'm not going to mention the brand because I don't want to mention that. But it's a well-known brand of really high-quality speakers he had. It's like, oh my God, this is amazing. And so he, you know, wrote a few big checks to fund the development of a new company. And we're like, wow, can we even run with this? So we studied the market extensively, hired some really expensive business planners and analysts. And they said, yeah, there's a business there. So the business started 6 years ago. It was like the beginning of that. I think we finally got to market with real product about 4 years ago. And we now have a whole range of loudspeakers, from a little bookshelf size speaker about this big, you know, about 13 inches tall by 10 inches wide and 6 inches deep, all the way to this Mahangus that we call the Alpha, that's about 5.5 feet tall and will drive a 70-foot long room at ear piercing levels. Wow. And I'm really happy with what it does. So the main concept behind it is, by using these, your life as an integrator is made easier, because it just comes together easier. A lot of things were thought out so that the installation's easier, the calibration's faster, everything just comes together easier. And so that's where we are. And so I got to tell you, you didn't ask me this, but I know we're like going well into time, but check this out, Jeremy. You asked me, what does PMI do? One of the things PMI does in the end is to go on site and spend 2 to 3 days calibrating the audio of a full Atmos system. It usually takes 2 or 3 days. So I travel somewhere with two suitcases full of test equipment that make the airlines go nuts because it all looks really dangerous in there. And they're always asking me, what's in this? It's like, it's an analyzer and a multiplexer and microphones. Here, let me show you. Like, hey, shut up. Just get out of here. And that's how it's normally done. I go on site, lots of gear. Well, from this room in Buenos Aires, Argentina, yesterday I calibrated a theater in Brussels, full Atmos. So 9.4.4 system. So 3 front speakers, wide sides, backs, 4 top speakers, 4 subwoofers, by remote control in about 7 hours. With me being here at this particular computer in this room, remote controlling the full system in Brussels, there is a technician on the other side. There's a person there listening, moving the microphone, you know, confirming what I'm seeing and hearing. We're looking at each other on a conference call like this, and I'm driving by remote control the application that sets up the whole thing. And in the end, the technician is like, this sounds amazing. Sounds as good as our demo room that I did for them, you know, in person a few years ago. And you can do that. And that's an amazing testament to the success of the vision, which is like, there is a way to make this easier. Mm. There's a way to make this technologically advanced to where we can leverage the power of the internet of things. Mm-hmm. And there's a way for me to be, you know, at my parents-in-law in Buenos Aires, Argentina, calibrating a theater in Brussels. Mm. Can't do that with other systems.
Well, I think we need to talk again because there's still so much more to even discuss with Grimani Systems and the projects that you're working on with that. But I think we're going to need to wrap it up because it's been about an hour and I really do appreciate your time and I've learned so much about you. Tony, thanks so much for joining me today. I really had a great time talking to you.
Jeremy, this was fun. For all of those of you who actually sat through an hour of this babble, thank you so much for your attention. Maybe we can edit some of this out. But yeah, this is fun. I'd love to do more of it. There's plenty more to chat about and have a good time with.
Absolutely. Tony Grimani is owner of PMI, MSR Acoustics, and Grimani Systems. If you want to track down Tony, probably the best place to start would be his PMI website, PMILTD.com. That wraps up today's show. Thanks to everybody for joining us. If you're new to the show, be sure to share, subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts. And check out all the latest residential tech news at ResTechToday.com. Until next time, please stay safe, stay inspired, and let us know if you have a great story to tell.
Residential Tech Talks. Lighting specialist to Residential Tech. Smart House.